brief introduction about Maharaj. Devata Swami is a direct disciple of Srila Prabhupada, who is the founder of Hare Krishna movement. As you may know, he is a graduate from Yale University. Soon after graduation, Maharaj came in touch with books of Srila Prabhupada, and then onwards he started practicing the message of Bhagavad Gita. And now, past few decades, he is traveling around the globe and he is spreading the message of Bhagavad Gita. He constantly visits prestigious universities and companies around the globe. He travels US, UK, Russia, India, Australia, New Zealand, and many other countries. He frequently visits top institutions in India, such as IITs and IIMs. And also, we are very happy to receive him, irrespective of his busy schedule. So I would like to hand over to Devata Swami. Thank you very much.
We're very happy that so many of you have gathered here this weekend. We're going to have very interesting discussions, getting to the heart of your situation in this world, in the body you have now, in the time that you are living, the situation you're living, your hopes, your dreams, your aspirations, your crises, your downfalls, and your achievements. We'll be discussing all those things. You all have come to Australia at a very interesting time. Perhaps, let's say, when we first started having these retreats, what year was that? Who knows? 2004. 2004 only? 2003. The world was a little bit different. People were still upbeat about material achievement. They had faith in material progress. And the overseas students who attended these special gatherings here, they still had confidence that it's possible to live a happy material life. But now, your generation, when I say your generation, I mean this present wave of overseas students, you're encountering a completely different terrain. Hope in materialism is starting to crack, and no one knows what to do. The lucky country, Australia, is in the midst of such a severe drought. It's stopped exporting rice, and so the rice prices throughout the world have shot up. The people are cracking up due to stress, anxiety. And also by this time, we have seen enough of the evidence of what happens to the overseas students in terms of their children, because most of you all will marry. Any potential brahmacharis here? And marriage means children, and those children will be growing up in Australia. Those of you who are first-year students, you all will say, 90% of you will say, oh, when we finish, we're returning to India. We've seen this movie year after year. As you rise to the second, the third year, then even your master's studies, a few of you, PhD, well, it's not that I like it here. It's just the infrastructure is better. So as you continue with your education, the percentages of those of you who think you're going to return drops drastically. We've been doing these gatherings long enough to observe the scientific results, the statistics, you know. So we're not surprised when so many of you who have just come for your first year are so sure, no, I'm just going to finish my studies, I'll be going back. We're not bewildered by this. So, you have a unique situation, this present wave of students. young professionals, aspiring professionals. In one sense, you could say you missed the boat. You missed the times of unabashed, unrestrained, unhesitant materialism. When there was full faith that just make a lot of money, swim with the sharks, and you'll be happy. Those were the days. But you missed that boat. Is that bad? You have come at a very special time when pure faith in materialism is starting to reduce. And people are wondering what to do, what's wrong? Food prices are shooting up. Employment opportunities are difficult. It seems that the Western dream is just that, a dream. Of course, now that dream has hit India. And we have now sufficient time to analyze what the effects on India, what are the effects on India of the Western dream of consumerism hitting. I was just watching a documentary on the family heir of the company, the business in India that makes what the Raymond suits. Yes, yes, he has inherited the business. And the documentary showed him flying around Mumbai in his helicopter. And then in the evenings when he wanted to relax, he had his speedboat. And he was known to be a famous playboy who recently in his old age began to slow down. And so he was glorifying the rise of commercialism in India. He was very excited. It's all about consumerism. It's all about desire. In fact, he's shaking with ecstasy. Like he was pronouncing sacred mantras. Consumerism. Desire. So, now we can analyze, even at this early stage, the effects of consumerism and unrestricted desire. What is the effect that's happening? What's the effect that's happening in India? And we start to see the same telltale signs, the same deteriorations that have long appeared in the Western world. Executives, young executives, having heart attacks, not in their 40s, not in their 30s, but now even in the 20s. So much stress problem. People working, young people working at call centers, and the call centers have to have a staff of psychologists, you know, because the young people are just cracking up from the stress of working these call centers. They get so much abuse when the people abroad find out their call is directed to India. You people are taking all our jobs, and now I want technical support for Dell, and my call goes to India. You are the one who took my job. And they start, you know, using so many abusive terms. And so the pressure is so great that every call center has to have as part of its staff a psychologist or two because the employees are cracking up. And you know about the divorce rate in India. It's no longer a minority. It's no longer something that's very uncommon. In fact, it's quite common now. So all these social ills that you were sure were just part of the Western world, now it's happening in India. So whether you look at Australia or you look at the big cities back home, you find the same problems. So there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. Better to face your destiny that you're in a special period of history in which you can have a great effect on how the world evolves. You're in that in-between period, in the crack, in the between pure faith in materialism and people becoming immersed in genuine spiritual science. You're right in that twilight period. So you can play an enormous role in bringing sanity to the world. You can be the forebearers, the ones who are carrying the torch. Now you may say, well, it sounds good what you're saying, but I don't know if my destiny is going to be to carry the torch of genuine spiritual science. I'm here to make money. And while making money, to enjoy some things that I probably wouldn't do at home, but no one will find out anyway. Right? You don't have to answer. So, by your good fortune, you've gathered here in this very sacred place where countless students and young professionals have preceded you in the previous years. Wave after wave have come and sat in this room. They start out with complete doubts. Okay, Swami, are you going to tell us some Hindu granny folklore? We've heard all the Mahabharata stories. We know the Ram Leelas. We know all that. We are critical thinkers. We are analytical. When we first started, everyone who attended was IT. And then with the dot-com bust, then things shifted. Then more and more you started getting accountants, hospitality. According to the PR situation, the occupational interest shift. So let me ask you all now. How many IT here? Raise your hand. Still a good number. Yes, maybe 1/6. Okay. How many accountants? Raise your hand. A little bit more. How many hospitality? Raise your hand. Okay. Any chefs? Okay. And the new one. I never could believe this would happen. Social welfare. Anyone? Raise your hand, please. Yes. Don't be. It's all right. Yeah. You're on the cutting edge, right? The others haven't caught on yet, right? Okay. So, as I said previously, wave after wave of you have come. And some have been a bit cynical, and then have been surprised that the spiritual scientific knowledge of India actually is the world's greatest treasure. So many of you have realized that actually we didn't know our own knowledge base. We thought it was just some kind of mythology. Of course, often, unfortunately, the way knowledge of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, the Krishna conscious texts, the way they're presented in India is not a proper way, and so therefore it comes across as folk tales, mythology. Here we have as our mission statement to give you the genuine spiritual knowledge, so that you can see the scientific application. Here we don't give you religious belief. Well, don't worry. We give you the pure spiritual science as Lord Krishna has taught, with the laboratory application, so you can verify everything that Krishna has said. Now, if you believe in Krishna, you believe in Bhagavad Gita, that's very good, but this doesn't impress us that much. You may believe, you may not believe. Let us look at the facts. Let us look at the realities. Let us enter the laboratory. So if your grandmother gave you some religious belief, that's very nice, but we want to move much higher than that. Many of you have no belief at all. That's also good. because it's easier to teach you the right thing. For example, just 1 second. There is a famous music school in Vienna, Austria, where people go to learn classical piano. And they have two different rates of tuition. One rate of tuition is for persons who have taken piano lessons before, and the other rate is for persons who have never taken piano lessons. The ones who pay more are those who have taken lessons before, because they think they know everything, and they have to be unlearned. And it's easier to teach those who have never taken lessons before. So often, when I'm speaking at IIT, other places of high repute in India, a reaction can be, "Oh, Swami, we know about Krishna. We know." Later, the students are shocked to realize they don't know. We have to make a vigorous effort to erase the hard drive of all the misconceptions and install the real knowledge as Krishna has given. So many viruses are floating around about Bhagavad Gita, Krishna. One of the viruses is, "Oh, there are many gods. Just pick one. Doesn't make a difference. Oh, worship them all. That's the best insurance policy." You worship them all, you're bound to be right, you know? All inclusive. We'll discuss those things, if you like, and we'll be open to questions. We want to stimulate your intellects. We'll also be discussing the life of the hybrid. Now, what is a hybrid? Anyone have any idea? Do we have any agricultural scientists here? No. No PR for agricultural scientists. I know. Everyone's going back to India. Hybrid is not a seed. Huh? Close.
Hybrid.
Yeah.
First generation hybrid.
Hybrid means 1 foot in India, 1 foot in Australia. Yes, mixed species. The hybrid has very special psychology and very special, challenges. You'll find that the hybrid, although often he or she won't admit it, can't go back to India and can't feel completely comfortable in Australia. We're kind of caught in between two worlds. So our specialty here is the hybrids. Due to their feeling displaced, due to their not having any firm foundation, they actually are motivated to start thinking more. Because they're like a cloud which has no place in the sky. They don't fit completely into the Indian sky, they don't fit completely into the Australian sky, so because of this feeling of dislocation, they start to think, "Who am I? What is this world? What is my future?" And we like speaking to the hybrids because they have motivation to use their intelligence. They're not so bound by traditions and customs. And they have proved to be fertile ground for hearing genuine spiritual science. They know how to recognize something that's genuine. And they're not interested in religious belief and folklores. And they want to hear the straight facts, the laboratory experiences that come from applying Krishna's instructions. All right. We've given you an overview of what you can expect. And now let's begin. We'd like to put a quotation from one of the, probably the most famous scientists in the world. Can we get the full screen? This is the cream of Western intellect. Such a profound statement. Everyone here recognizes this name. What do you think? He's the most brilliant scientist, as popularly conceived, and of course, adored by other scientists. What about his mission statement? How does that sit with you? How many of you feel that you're just chemical scum? Raise your hands. One brave person raises. Why do you feel that way?
Because it's always like reacting, like we are always reacting with situations. So we are like a chemical.
Who is we and what is we?
I'm just including myself.
What's that?
I'm just talking about myself.
Yes, yes, okay, that's what I mean. Who are you? What are you? You're just chemical scum, right? Chemical scum has become conscious, huh? Miraculous, isn't it? That's a wonderful religious belief, isn't it? That chemicals have developed advanced consciousness. Can you see that as a religious belief? There's no proof whatsoever for it. No one has ever seen it happen. No one has ever seen anything near like that happening. That means religious belief. Did you know you're a true believer? Never thought about it that way. Don't worry, we've just started here. We're going to teach you a lot of things you never thought of before. Things have just begun. Yes, chemical scum. If life, if the living entity is just chemicals, then you should prove it. What's the proof? Who knows? Enter the laboratory and do what? Produce any life. Why, humans, any living thing with just chemicals. Don't take anything that's already living. Just take chemicals. Otherwise, you have religious belief. Life comes from matter. Consciousness comes from matter. Saying that consciousness comes from matter is like saying time comes from clocks. Look at your watch and tell me, how does time come out of the watch? Watches are indicators of the passing of time, but watches don't create time. Similarly, there may be changes in the brain due to changes in consciousness, but that doesn't mean the brain has produced consciousness. You understand what I'm saying? So here you have arguably the greatest scientist. And he's making a statement like this. What do you think the effect is on the intelligence of people? Most people actually, even though they may repeat this, they don't feel comfortable with it. They can't identify with it. So this is the big problem with science today. It's not doing anything to solve the problems of the inner self. And in fact, it's causing big problems outside of you. So there's no knowledge of the self and rampant destruction of the environment. Furthermore, if we are just chemical scum, why worry about anything? If you see some chemical scum on a pot or a plate, you just wash it down the drain. So let's just wash you all down the drain. Let's wash Stephen Hawking down the drain too. Why should you protest? It's just chemical scum. If I say please, maybe wash you down the drain. Or you're too big to go down the drain. So we'll take you to Queensland, to a river where there are crocs. Let the crocs take care of you. You say, why worry? You're just chemical scum. We'll feed some chemical scum to the crocs. Now, you won't like that, right? Your parents won't appreciate it. What is it about us, then, that we think is so valuable that we can't be washed down the drain like chemical scum? Real knowledge answers that question. And unfortunately, material scientists, they know nothing about the answer. This is the great problem in the Western world. We're going to talk about that more. Okay, let's give credit where credit is due. Very few of us here will deny that the particular type of technological progress that we've seen in the West since the Renaissance times, few of us will deny that it's incomparable in the recent memory of humanity. In what is known as human history, no one can remember a time when there's ever been such technological performance. Nevertheless, we should ask ourselves a question, whether we're IT people or accountants or hospitality or social welfare or chefs, we should ask ourselves a question, a very essential question. Is the kind of progress that we've seen in the world, is that the only type of progress, or is it beneficial progress? People are starting to ask this question. Progress today means pursuit of production, consumption, and urbanization. When you go back to India, you see that's what it's all about, right? More production, more consumption, more urbanization. These things haven't worked in the West. Why should they work in India? Just like now, the statistics for Mumbai and Delhi. How many are from Mumbai here? And how many Delhiwalas? So many. So, in Mumbai, every day, 150 new cars hit the road. In Delhi, 250. Now, just think of the traffic there already. Is it so that every day 150 new roads are appearing in Mumbai? 250 new roads are appearing in Delhi? So what's going on? Where are all the cars going to fit? You know, the co-sharers of the Nobel Prize for this year, one was Al Gore, the other was the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They co-shared the Nobel Prize. So, the secretary of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, he's from India. And so he was asked by the news media, what do you think about the new world's cheapest car? Has it come yet? Not yet. Just now coming? December. All right. How much? $2,500. All right. So, how many of you feel this is a great step forward? This is wonderful. Raise your hands. How many of you aren't sure? Raise your hands. How many of you think, this is bad news? Raise your hands. Not everyone's saying. Well, the secretary of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Nobel Prize winning, as I said, he's from India. He was asked, how do you think about this new car, world's cheapest car? Oh, I'm having nightmares. I can't sleep at night. Because he knows the environmental impact. It's going to be a disaster. But you can't tell the people that. The people don't want to look at the overall picture. The government doesn't want to look at the overall picture. And certainly the ones who are selling the cars don't want you to look at the overall picture. Is this really progress? Now, I know many of you are thinking, well, we didn't come here to Australia to do a critique of Western progress. We came here to partake in it and get our share, right? I mean, it's going on, so we didn't start it. We've got to live, you know? We just want our share. I mean, you know, it may be environmentally damaging, it may be mentally and physically destructive, it may, you know, be full of stress and anxiety, but anyway, there's something out there, and we should get it, right? And we'll sort things out later. You know, each wave of overseas students that comes, they all have the same unspoken conception that, all right, we know about the social problems in Australia. We've seen how the Aussies live. We've even, you know, imitated a few things. Yeah. No need to talk about that. But you see, here's, this is what, you know, we'll do it differently. We're Indians. We'll do the Aussie thing differently. We won't. We'll get the best of what they have and avoid all the problems they have. Each wave of overseas students has that, you know, has that fantasy. That yeah, we know they're destroying themselves with materialism, but we'll do it differently. We'll succeed. We may drink, but we won't drink too much. Right? Not like the Aussies. Oh, they drink so much. No, we'll never do drinking so much. Yeah, no. And we may do other unmentionable things, but never so that it interferes with our performance at the workplace. Right? There's this pride, which actually is unfounded because life is very simple. You act in a certain way, you get a certain result. You know, probably 45 years ago, 50 years ago, the Aussies were, other than maybe meat eating, they were probably just like you, you know. But it's natural that as time progresses, the consciousness of the human being degrades. This is Kali Yuga, for those of you who don't know anything about spiritual science or spiritual knowledge. This particular time of human civilization is the worst in terms of inner development and inner qualities. Things are always deteriorating. So the problems that you all are dealing with now, the agitations, the temptations you face, for your children, it'll be multiplied by 50. And you know already what the challenges are that you face, the temptations. You see it on the internet all the time, right? You're not just looking at the news on the internet, right? You see it in the movies. Obviously, you all have come here this weekend with some curiosity about something better. And yes, indeed, we have something better to offer to you. But first, we have to face that essential question. Is progress as we have been given it, production, consumption, urbanization, is that the only way to judge an advanced civilization? All right. Generally, when you look from a conventional point of view at human history in this world, there are always certain markers for stages of development in so-called human civilization. Let's take a look at some of them. You'll find it presented differently by different scholars. First, becoming human. 100,000, 150,000, now it's even pushed back as far as 200,000 years ago in Africa. Apes developed brains, and they walked upright, and human beings appeared, as known now. So the first thing is becoming human. This is conventional human history. I'm not saying that this is the understanding you'll get from Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam. Then, inventing civilization. Human beings started to gather into villages and small cities where not everyone was a farmer. So, this is considered to be civilization, when people gather together and they do other things besides farming. Very interesting definition of civilization, but anyway, that's what people think. Then, developing a conscience, the world religions developed in the Middle East and the Near East. Christianity, Islam, people try to think, am I doing right? Am I doing wrong? Now, India is not included in this phase of developing a conscience because it's too difficult for scholars to put a date on India's spiritual traditions and India's spiritual texts. So when they talk about developing a conscience, they're just referring to, you know, the Middle Eastern, Near Eastern religions, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, like that. So they say, you know, some thousands of years ago, 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, human beings wanted to feel right and have a sense of avoiding wrong, so world religions sprung up. Okay. Meanwhile, there was something going on in India, who understands it? Yeah. Seeking a lasting peace. Supposedly that was the motivation when world empires began to be established. The Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire. Supposedly their motivation was by establishing empires they would make world peace. In other words, if you didn't agree to be peaceful their way, they'd simply kill you. So, thinking of lasting peace. Achieving rationality. This was the Renaissance when science as we know it took birth. People weren't so caught up anymore in religious belief. Just because a priest said something didn't mean it was true. So this is supposed to be the time when rationality was achieved. Everything had to be empirical, laboratory data. Then uniting the planet. This was when the societies in Europe began to connect with the Americas, India, Africa. They call it uniting the planet. Actually, it should be colonizing the planet. Anyway, in the history books, they say uniting the planet. When the British went all over the world, that was uniting the planet. Then, releasing nature's energies. The Industrial Revolution. People suddenly realized that nature was not just to be admired for its beauty, but nature should be exploited. And then, finally, democracy arose, especially in the 20th century. And of course, now you have India, the world's biggest democracy. And the end result of democracy is supposedly ruling ourselves. Power from the people. Well, this is the conventional way that the world is presented to you, but let's look at the reality. Pretending to be humans. No one knows what is the real difference between a human being and an animal. You are trying to buy food, you want shelter, an animal also wants food and shelter. You are trying to protect yourself, the animal is also trying to protect itself. Human beings are concerned with procreating, mating. Well, so is the animal. So, what is the real difference between the human being and the animal? No one has figured that out. Best you can say is that human beings are royal editions of the animals. But why are human beings special? In Bhagavad Gita and in Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna And the great Krishna conscious teachers explained that the human body is special because it has developed consciousness to have a discussion like we're having now. But if the human being simply becomes absorbed in animal pursuits, although in a more sophisticated way, then this is not human life. You're just pretending to be human. Whether you think human beings arose in Africa or India or South America, that's not the point. The point is, a real human being is one who understands the developed consciousness and how to use it to attain the highest destination. That is real human life. Okay, next. Attempting civilization. In other words, just because people start living in cities, small cities, and not all of them are farming, that doesn't mean civilization. Civilization means a culture in which people are striving to understand their identity beyond matter. They don't think they're chemical scum. Anytime you have the greatest so-called brains in society saying we're just chemical scum, that means no civilization. Groping for a conscience. The development of the world's religions, as conventionally known, are an attempt how to have some moral standard. We haven't really seen any peace in this world because of religion, because so many persons who claim to be religious slaughter so many other creatures unnecessarily. And because they slaughter other creatures, naturally, the reaction is they'll slaughter themselves. So you see that in spite of human beings saying that they're religious, they just end up killing everything around them. In Sanskrit, the word for meat is mamsa. Me, you. That means you're telling the animal, I'm eating you, and I'll allow that in the next life you can eat me. Mamsa. Next time you go by McDonald's and you're tempted, think of that. Look at the picture on the window of the Big Mac and think, Mamsa, you, me. So how can there be a genuine religious conscience when there's so much animal slaughter going on? Now the environmentalists are so concerned. What's going to happen if the rising Indian middle class starts having the Western meat-eating diet? There's not enough resources in the world to feed animals so the animals get fat and then the human beings can eat the animals. The civilized method is give the grains directly to the human beings, not give the grains to animals and then the human beings eat the animals. This is so environmentally destructive. So everyone is scratching their heads. What to do if the Indians and the Chinese start increasing their meat eating? How is the world going to keep up with that? Before, we saw achieving rationality. But how can you call it rationality when science can't teach you what you are? According to the Renaissance, rationality took birth. In other words, no more religious belief, but laboratory proof. But we say that that's artificial intelligence. Our definition of artificial intelligence is not machine-produced intelligence. That's how people define now artificial intelligence. We say artificial intelligence is when humans neglect their identity, don't understand who they are or why they are here, and yet they come out with so many plans and so many technologies. This is artificial intelligence. And you've seen that artificial intelligence cover the world since the Renaissance. Okay. We talked about so-called uniting the planet. When colonies were established all over the world in India, North America, Africa, South America. That's not uniting a planet. That's dividing up the planet for exploitation. Enslavement. And then, tapping into nature's resources? No. Destroying nature's resources. What kind of intelligent creature destroys its own habitat, destroys its own bed? Do you see animals do that? But these human beings have done that. And we are playing a part in all that environmental destruction. And finally, through democracy, are you really ruling yourself? No. Depressing ourselves. We'll see later how depression is the world's fastest rising disease, especially in the developed world, like Australia, USA, UK, Europe. Depression is the fastest growing disease in terms of disease impact. So, how is it that we're ruling ourselves? No, we are depressing ourselves. This is a result of so-called progress today. So when we look at society and our situation now, we should be honest about it and realize the challenges. We turn to the spiritual knowledge of ancient India. Think about this. You truly want to be wealthy? That means you use the spiritual knowledge of Bhagavad Gita to solve the problems of life. Otherwise, it's not human life. Please allow yourself to be motivated by these statements. Okay, before we go further, let's talk about information. I know some of you may have the fear that if you take this Krishna consciousness, Sanatana Dharma, seriously, you'll be rejecting all the information and knowledge of today. This is an unnecessary paranoia, an unnecessary, unfounded fear. You see, let's look at the crucial difference between genuine spiritual knowledge and the information like you're studying at the university. The essential difference is not about the value of information. No, in both the spiritualist and the materialist, say you should have the best information. Krishna consciousness is the best spiritual information, the most comprehensive spiritual knowledge found in the world. So it's not that we are rejecting the value of acquiring information. Maybe some of you have that fear. If I start chanting Hare Krishna too much, my abilities for acquiring information will shut down. I'll lose my competitiveness at the workplace. I won't be able to keep up at the university because I'll no longer have enthusiasm for the process for acquiring information. No. There's no argument about the need to acquire information. The argument is about what is valuable information. That is the point. Is material information so valuable? Many of you know that even materially speaking, what you're studying at the university won't have that much application when you get a job. Many of you know that. You're just studying in order to get the piece of paper, and then most of your education happens on the job. I know quite a few of you, of our regulars, of our staff, when they went to get a job, especially in IT, when the human resource person asked them, do you know such and such system? Do you know such and such language? Do you know such and such IT, whatever? Oh, yes, I know all about it. All right, please report to work, and we have some problems we want you to solve. Immediately. And these are Krishna conscious practitioners. Immediately they go home, stay up all night studying. Show up the next day at work. Yes, yes, I'm knowing everything. So, it's not that by your becoming Krishna conscious, you lose your ability to get knowledge, information. Instead, you know what is valuable information. This is what we're arguing about. Not whether you should get information, but what is the most valuable information. How can you consider knowledge of the body to be more important than knowledge of the spirit soul? But even in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is talking about knowledge of matter, but it's put in a secondary position to knowledge of the spiritual energy. That's all. You get to see things in perspective. If the body is secondary, then that means also that knowledge of the body and matter is secondary. So why should we want to just be material exclusivists, just focusing on knowledge of matter and forgetting all about the most important knowledge? That is the question. So please forget all about this notion that, oh, how can we go away from the information age and just become religious believers? Mm-mm. Krishna consciousness is about the perfection of information. Here we get to a very important issue. Everyone wants to live long. Supposedly, by coming to Australia, and most of you will stay as we discuss, you've increased your longevity in terms of statistics, right? By living in Australia, the average statistical duration of your life has increased. Is the value of life just living a long time? Or is something else more valuable? We see here the statement of Shukadeva Goswami in Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the graduate study to Bhagavad Gita. He makes a very powerful point. What is the value in this world of a prolonged life that is wasted by years of inexperience? Better a moment of full consciousness, Krishna consciousness, because that gives us a start in searching after our supreme interest. Think about that. It's not the length of your life that's important, it's the quality of your life, the quality of the consciousness. So, sometimes people think that, well, we know that in the spiritual texts of ancient India, they're always saying that life is temporary and that what's the point in making temporary progress in a temporary world? You should understand this is true. However, nowhere in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna say the world is false or non-existent. It's just like a mirage. A mirage, although it's not the real thing, it does exist. So this material world is like that. We go to sleep at night, we forget all about our daytime existence, and we get lost in the dream world. We wake up in the morning, we forget all about the dream world, and we enter the working or the studying world or the family world. Both are dreams. It's simply the night dream and the daydream. What is real? At night you're dreaming, I am such and such body. During the day you're dreaming, I am such and such body. So both are dreams. Dreams have existence, but they're not the real thing. Please bear in mind that when the spiritual literature talks about life is temporary, it doesn't mean you should just give up and do nothing. It's explaining the facts. Life is temporary, the world is temporary, the body is temporary. What are you going to do about it? Sometimes people think that by discussing how temporary the life is, the body is, the world is, you're just being negative. And you won't have that ambition to get ahead. But what is getting ahead? Real getting ahead means to use the temporary body and temporary world to achieve the eternal, to achieve Krishna. That's really getting ahead. So it's not that the Krishna conscious practitioner is just lost in negativity. Oh, the world's just temporary. The body's temporary. No point in doing anything. No one ever says like that. You see, there's a difference between alerting everyone that the world and the body are temporary and saying that the world is false. Please keep that in mind. The crucial question is what to do with the temporary body? What to do with the temporary world? Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, he teaches you what to do. How to use this temporary body and temporary world so that you'll achieve perfection. Please think about that. Why should you just look at this one life as all in all? Why not learn how to see your life as like one frame in a film strip and be concerned with the whole movie of many frames, not just one frame? So the way of looking at life is very different when presented in the spiritual texts compared to the insane way that people live these days. People say can't even have a healthy, stress-free one life. they may say one life is all there is, but they can't even have a nice one life. I saw a sign for a fitness center in Australia. One body, one life, one opportunity. How many of you agree with that? Raise your hands. How many of you think there's more than one life? Raise your hands. How many are not sure? Fair enough. Okay. So, very few of you, if any, believe there's just one life. So that means you need to know the art, science, and culture of how to live this life so you get the best now and the best in the future. Do we expect that all of you are going to become like full transcendentalists? A transcendentalist is one who completely focuses on the supreme destination and is not at all caught up in the temporary. Do we expect you all to become like that? No. You see, the knowledge of bhakti yoga, as Krishna presents in Bhagavad Gita, is for both the express train people and the slow train people. Slow train, what does that mean? The gradual. Yes, I know the world's temporary, but I'm attached to some things in this world. So let me act in such a way that I can increase gradually my spiritual attachment and gradually decrease my material attachment. This is the slow train. That's okay. That is legitimate way of approaching Krishna consciousness. But there are always going to be some eager beavers, some really keen persons who will think, well, if this world is just temporary and the real world, the real self is eternal, let's go for the top. There'll always be a few like that. The transcendentalists. But what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita is for both the gradualists and the transcendentalists. For the express train people and the slow train people. How many potential express train people do we have here? Raise your hands. See? Yes, Krishna understands that. How many potential slow train people do we have here? Raise your hands. Yes. That's the reality. But the science of Krishna consciousness can handle all types. So don't have this prejudice that the spiritual knowledge that Krishna gives is just for the out-of-the-world people, the express train people, who just want to focus on the supreme destination, and that's it. No, Krishna's instructions are for everyone. The proof of that is that Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna on a battlefield in between two armies. That's Lord Krishna's way of letting you know that Bhagavad Gita is completely practical. Now, was Arjuna a sadhu? Was he a brahmachari? Was he a sannyasi? Now, Arjuna was a family man and a military man. How much more practical can you be than that? And Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to him. Krishna is showing you. This is not knowledge to shut yourself away from the world. This is knowledge of how to live in this world in perfection. Let's go on. This is the first verse of Bhagavad Gita, chapter 1. Some of you may recognize it. Dhritarashtra, the blind grandfather, is asking his secretary, Sanjaya, "O Sanjaya, after my sons, the Kauravas, and the sons of Pandu, assembled in the place of pilgrimage at Kurukshetra, desiring to fight, what did they do?" Even now you'll find Kurukshetra there in India. But this scene is 5,000 years ago. This is the situation in which Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita. A battlefield. More practical than the workplace. More practical than this classroom, than the lecture hall. The battlefield. That's where knowledge of Bhagavad Gita is spoken. To show you it's completely practical. Now let's look at our situation. I thought you would like that. Yes, what are you going to do? Assemble that the place of passion, sense gratification, degradation, mental, physical pollution. What are you going to do? You're here, you've gathered here to make money and enjoy. What's going to happen? What will become of you? Unless you have some understanding of higher knowledge, higher culture, you'll be caught up in the same problems that the Australians are having. You, as well as your children, will have the same problems. You should be able to see ahead and change course. In order to change course, to change your direction, to change your path, you need to understand the real treasure of India. The world's greatest spiritual knowledge. Not religious belief, but laboratory spiritual science. That's what Krishna consciousness is about. And that's what Lord Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita. All right. Here's information from the National Institute of Mental Health in the USA. You want to see the effects of the culture that you're now participating in. These are statistics. The leading sources of disease burden in established market economies. Established market economies is the term used to apply to, you know, the USA, Australia, New Zealand, UK, you know, Germany, France, like that. Look at the disease list. Number one, heart disease. Number two, major depression. Followed by cardiovascular heart disease, alcohol use, road traffic accidents, lung and other cancers. Look at that list. Diabetes is way down at number 9. Arthritis, number 8. But depression is number 2. What kind of society, what kind of culture does that? You look around at your workplace. Are you impressed by the locals, how they live? No. You see, they can't function without intoxication, right? And I explained to every wave of students, why is it that you all have a chance to get a job? What is the reason? Is it simply population shortage? Why is it that you all have a chance to get a job in Australia? Who knows? Yes?
Because Indian families are more stable and they don't have any disorders.
Indian families are more stable and they have no disorders. Others? Why do you have a chance to get a job? Yes?
Because most of the Australians, they drink in the weekends and they can't work.
They drink on the weekends and come to work Monday just in a daze, right?
Indians are more reliable.
Indians are more reliable. Okay, anyone else? Yes?
Indians are better in English and...
You mean they don't speak Strine? They don't say things like Brecky and Prezi and... If you wait till you call, you are calling to your family in India, and you say to your mother, "How are the rallies?" I've got some prezzies for my rallies. All right, so okay, yes, you speak better English. Any other reasons why you have a chance to get a job?
We can handle pressure better than Australians, maybe.
You can handle pressure better. How is that? If there's more work and more money. Go on, no.
More money, like not even more money. Like
not even more. Oh. You're not a charity worker.
I'm doing charity. I work for Accenture, and we work 8 to 8 sometimes on Tuesday and Thursday.
You work for Accenture? Why do you do it?
Because
Why does he do it? Why does he work 8 to 8 for Accenture?
Impress the boss
to keep the job. That's the big IT outfit? Yes. I know persons who work for Accenture. And if you don't keep up with the pace, out you go. They don't say we fire you. They have a nice term at Accenture. Unfortunately, we have to cancel you out. You don't want to hear that. Therefore, you work 8 to 8.
It's like move out or move up or move out.
Right. You got to swim with the sharks, right? Keep up in the rat race, right? Any other reasons why you have a chance to get jobs? So all these reasons are basically about you're being a superior candidate for employment because the employers, the human resources people, they see, oh, we don't have to worry about him coming in drunk on Monday. We don't have to worry about a nervous breakdown on Tuesday because, you know, his girlfriend who he was living with for 5 years without marriage suddenly ran off with the neighbor. So many things like that. I know. In New Zealand, I've explained at previous retreats, one corporate human resource person was telling me, look, he said, if we need to hire someone, and the applicants, they're Kiwis, New Zealanders, they're Chinese, and they're Indians. And first we go for the Indians. Second we go for the Chinese, and only in the last, there's no other choice. We look at our own people. For just the reasons that you said. So right now you are more productive. You can be more focused, work longer hours, day after day, year after year. But why do you have that superiority? Who can say? Why? Is it genetic? Huh?
We have been brought up in such an environment, we have like pushed so many people through, and we have had so a lot of competitions, and through all of our upbringing, we have had, you know.
Had what?
We've gone through a lot of strife and a lot of tough competitions throughout our life, and we have pushed so many people apart and then moved to a place where we are at the moment.
Pushed so many people aside?
Yes. Oh. We made our way by pushing so many people, and we had so many competitions, and we sort of beat the rabbits to a certain extent.
You sort of, what was that? The last thing you said?
Yeah, I'm saying that we sort of beat so many people. And
yes.
That's sort of mentality and the whole upbringing, the way it has been. So we have that upbringing in there, in our subconscious somewhere. Keep working, keep going forward, don't complain, don't look back, just keep moving ahead, whatever the circumstances are. And that's the sort of thing. So that's something which reflects in our culture and the way we deliver things.
Okay.
I think we have the same desire what the Western people had 50 years back. We want to develop now. They wanted to develop. They have already reached that state and we are...
They've already burned out.
Yeah.
And so you're new candidates for the oven. That's my point. In other words, yes, 50 years ago they were like you, except, you know, they were all meat eaters, but, you know, more or less they were like you. But... You know, they're burnt out, and now you're the new candidates for the oven. And also, you should look at the fact that there are cultural differences. You're coming from a culture that was known for stability and tradition, parents caring for their children, no divorce, family stability. Drinking was looked down upon as low class. Meat eating was looked down upon as barbaric. Girls remained chaste before marriage. Boys didn't play around before marriage. So all these cultural traits, which are actually leftovers of a spiritual culture, they have conferred upon you a competitive advantage now in the workplace. But as you participate in the workplace, what happens? You start giving up your very advantages, even unconsciously. You start to become fussified. Right? And then in 10 or 20 years, you'll be just like them, burnt in the oven. And what about your children? I say this again and again. Huh? No, they won't be hybrids. No, your children will tell you, I'm an Australian. No, they will be adamant about it. They're going to wear their hats backward and have the baggy pants. And when the cricket match comes between Australia and India, they're going to cheer for Australia. I've seen it. I've seen it happen. They're going to tell you, Father, I'm Australian. I don't want to live like my grandmother. I don't want to live like my grandmother and grandfather in Rajasthan or whatever. I am an Australian. Oh no, don't say that, don't say that. They want to be like their friends. And what are you going to be able to say? And just by your living here in Australia, you're taking up habits. Because all around you is meat eating, drinking. Already, the divorces are happening. Well, the divorces are happening in India. Why shouldn't you divorce here? So you're losing the competitive edge just by the effects of the atmosphere and your own choices. You're being overwhelmed. So the very thing that's making you successful now, you're giving up under the pressure of materialism. You know yourselves. It's hard to resist all that materialism, right? The alcohol everywhere, the meat. Why not give Sizzlers a try, right? Just try it out one time, Sizzlers, huh? Yeah. Oh, I mean, one time won't kill you. This is what's happening. And then because there is lust everywhere, naturally you become affected by that. It's on the internet. The men spend so much time on the internet looking at those things. So your mind becomes affected. Anyway, even in India now, young people are living together without marriage, right? It's considered the cool thing. So certainly, I know here at the universities it's going on. Here's the excuse that the young Indian couples who are living together without marriage give. Well, it's just that we're flatting together. It's cheaper that way. Have you heard that one? Yeah. It's just to save money, you know. Why should he have a flat and I have a flat? You know, better we just economize, you know. Of course, if something happens while we're living together, well, anyway, you know. We're living in Australia, you know. Our grandmother can't see us. Right? Yeah. These are the Western ways, you know, we are in Australia. Before marriage, one should experience the other person completely and then make up your mind. Right? This is going on. And the men live a double standard. The men say, when I marry, I want that the bride is pure. Right? But before marriage, I can fool around. Right? Yeah, you all know that's true. It puts so much pressure on the ladies. The pressure is on the ladies that they have to fool around now, but at the same time be pure at the time of marriage. It's not going to work, is it? So the men are creating this big mess, and the ladies are allowing them to do that. Because the ladies are afraid, oh, if we don't participate in all this, we won't, you know, no one will want us, we'll be bored, and everyone is doing like that in Australia. And the men don't understand. By the men pushing this kind of agenda, they're ruining themselves. They're ruining their future. So all these things are going on. What can the men do? They're constantly seeing what they shouldn't be seeing on the internet. And so then they want to put that in action. So either they have to find an Australian girl, or they have to find an Indian girl. This is what's happening. But now even in India there's so much divorce. So the very culture which is spiritually based, which has given you advantages in employment, that culture is now corroding, eroding, breaking down. What do you think of that? So if you're actually understanding the consequences, the impact of what you're saying about the things that make you superior and more desirable by the human resources, then you should act to preserve those positive things. Therefore, the Krishna conscious practitioner is materially as well as spiritually successful. You can look at, once you get to know them, the Krishna conscious practitioners, our staff, they're all doing well in their material fields. They're all highly sought after by employers. You can ask them while you're here. You can talk to Koti. You can talk to Krishna Katha. He just opened his own travel agency last year, and it's already at the top in Melbourne. So many examples of that. Gopar Vrindesh here, he just finished his PhD in telecommunications. So what's going on? Why haven't they lost their abilities? Because they're chanting Hare Krishna. Isn't that the fear? You chant Hare Krishna, you become too spiritual, right? But look, they're chanting Hare Krishna, they're practicing Bhagavad Gita, and easily they have the material success too. Truthfully though, the main reason to practice Krishna consciousness is not for material success. Nevertheless, it is a fact that even looked at materially, the Krishna conscious lifestyle it makes for a better life materially. The original culture of India is Krishna conscious. It's according to Bhagavad Gita. But everyone's forgotten the spiritual reasons why a certain culture is there. And so therefore, because they don't understand the spiritual reasons of the culture, they're giving up on the culture. That's the problem. So please think about that. We go deeper into Bhagavad Gita. No doubt so many of you have encountered very powerfully crushing situations in which you saw no good outcome. As they say here, you felt like you were between a rock and a hard place. Every option was unsatisfactory, undesirable. So this is the situation Arjuna is in now. And Krishna is going to speak to him the topmost knowledge, taking advantage of Arjuna's situation to present to you also the topmost spiritual science. I like that we all vibrate this verse together. You all can see on top the Sanskrit transliteration. Everyone in the back can see? Alright, let us, you repeat after me. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Sri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Kutastha Kashmilam
Idam. Kutastha Kashmilam Idam.
Vishame Samupashtitam.
Vishame Samupashtitam.
Anaya Jushtam Asvargyam.
Anaya Jushtam Asvargyam.
Akirti Karamarjuna.
Akirti Karamarjuna.
Very good. That was wonderful. Now, you'll see this when you read Bhagavad Gita. It's all academically presented. We have the synonyms. Repeat after me. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha.
Sri Bhagavan Uvacha.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead said.
Kuta.
Kuta.
Where from?
Tva,
unto you.
Kashmalam,
dirtiness.
Idam,
this lamentation.
Vishame,
in this hour of crisis.
Samupastitam,
arrived.
Anaya,
persons who do not know the value of life.
Jushtam,
practiced by.
Asvargyam,
which does not lead to higher planets. Akirti, infamy. Karam, the cause of. Arjuna, O Arjuna. Alright, the translation, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, my dear Arjuna, how have these impurities come upon you? They are not at all befitting a man who knows the value of life. They lead not to higher planets, but to infamy. So here you see, in the Sanskrit, the real definition of an Aryan. Krishna uses the negative here. Anarya means someone who's not an Aryan. Is an Aryan someone who has blue eyes and blonde hair, like Hitler thought? No. The real definition of an Aryan is not biological, it's not ethnic, it is cultural. Krishna says here, Anarya. A non-Aryan means a person who doesn't know the value of life, who doesn't understand the spiritual science. Whether he calls himself Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jew, Nazi, whatever, globalist. If he doesn't understand the higher values of life, he's an Anarya. He's not an Aryan. He's debased, degraded. So, Krishna is telling Arjuna, why are you acting like that? How have these impurities come upon you? The particular impurities that Krishna is referring to is Arjuna thinking he's the body, becoming bewildered on the bodily platform of life, misidentifying the body as a self, forgetting the identity as spirit soul, part of Krishna, the Supreme Soul. So Krishna is asking, you're my dear part and parcel. How these impurities come upon you? It's not befitting someone who has real knowledge, real culture. And then he says something, your mentality is not leading to the higher planets, but to infamy. We're going to talk about that in our next session, the life options for the future. What does this talk about, the next life, higher planets? What does all this mean in terms of your life choices? We'll get to that in our next session. But for now, we'll pause and ask if you have any questions. Usually in our first session, there are not so many questions because you're all processing. But as the weekend progresses, and as I provoke you more and more, there'll be more questions. But maybe we have some brave ones. There's always a few brave ones who want to ask questions in the first session. Yes, you get a special gift.
Prabhupada was about to answer the question that there is no doubt that we are born in the darkness of ignorance. And it happens that we adopt so many things that we should not if we would have knew the fact. We would have known the fact. And what happens is like once we want to take a bold step, we want to get out of that vicious cycle. But it has bewildered us, or it has entangled us in such a way that we don't know how to come out of it. So who is going to help us? Is Krishna coming to help us, or do we have to take a step forward?
This is a very beautiful question. And we'll be dealing with that in the next session because Arjuna is going to ask the same question. You already see how Arjuna is depressed. He's just overwhelmed with lamentation. And now Krishna is starting to pull him up straight, as the Aussies say. Pull him up a bit. Like, how have these impurities come upon you? Why did you get into this situation? You don't know what to do? Krishna will explain. Okay? So your question will be answered in this next session. It's a very important question. How do we get out of the situation we're into now? How do we make the best of it? Should we just drop our studies, drop our job, put on saffron, pretend to be a sadhu? Or is there a middle road in which we can do our work duties, our studying duties, and at the same time have a progressive life, that's gradually moving toward the spiritual perfection. We'll be talking about that, okay? I already pointed out, our staff here, they are practicing Krishna consciousness fully, but they are successful in their material endeavors. Yeah, PhDs, successful entrepreneurs, financiers, IT people. They have families. It's all happening, but it's Krishna focused. So you don't have to be, you don't have to be a saffronite. You see, in every field of endeavor, there are professors. But not every student becomes a professor. So I just decided to be a professor. Don't mind. I had my choice. I graduated, as you heard, from Yale University. And most of the presidents of the USA come from there. The current infamous president, as well as his father, who was president 13 years ago, also came from there. In the previous in two presidential elections ago, I think the year 2000, both candidates were from Yale. Some people say it's a conspiracy. Anyway, the point is, you might be thinking, why did I choose this route, this path? Well, I wanted to specialize in the topmost knowledge. I wanted to specialize in the topmost happiness. Not everyone wants to specialize, but there's always a few, and those few can bring value to others. Those few can serve others. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to serve others. Most persons who come to Krishna consciousness, who want to follow truly Krishna's instructions in Bhagavad Gita, they will adopt the gradual path, which is glorious. But there have to be some examples of those who are pushing ahead at a rapid pace. They do a service for the others. Just like in the ocean, when it's frozen in the winter, that in front of the ships there has to be the icebreakers, you know? So, the saffronites are the icebreakers. They do a difficult task on behalf of others. If I had a family, how would I be able to travel all over the world like I've been doing for over 30 years on every continent of the world? Instead of having my own biological family, I have the whole world as my family. So we'll speak more about your very beautiful question in the next session. How do you get out of this entanglement, this trap? What to do? Do you take a step toward Krishna, or does Krishna help you? I've heard sometimes persons say, I know that I'm an illusion, but when he wants, when Bhagavan wants, then he'll take me out. So now I don't do anything. That was a very wonderful question. Any other brave ones? All right. As the weekend goes on, you'll, and that, as I said, as I provoke you more, you'll. I'm provoking you on purpose because this is the most important subject matter, which requires your greatest intelligence, and you have that intelligence, so it should be applied to the best thing. All right, thank you very much for your attention. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.